This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. This week, the Senate Armed Services Committee grilled former military lawyers on exactly how the government concluded in 2002 it could legally use harsh interrogation techniques on detainees at Guantanamo Bay and other U.S.-controlled prisons. Few people know more about that subject than our guest, international human rights attorney Philippe Sands. His new book, Torture Team, concludes the effort to get legal clearance for tough interrogation methods like waterboarding came not from frustrated commanders in Guantanamo, as Bush administration officials claimed, but from top officials in the Pentagon and the White House. I spoke to Sands earlier this week, only days after the Supreme Court gave prisoners at Guantanamo access to federal courts to challenge their detention. Sands has worked on several high-profile cases, including the extradition of former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet. He's also a professor at University College London and author of an earlier book, Lawless World. Philippe Sands, welcome to Fresh Air. We had a far-reaching decision by the Supreme Court last week about the detainees at Guantanamo. The Bush administration, of course, has long held that these are non-state actors, combatants not entitled to the protections of the American legal system. The court apparently ruled that they do have a right to challenge their detention in American courts. Give us your take. What is the import of this ruling?
Well, it's very significant. It's been picked up all over the world. It's the third defeat on the trot by the administration. It may be the most important because this is one that can't be fixed without amending the Constitution. And essentially, it's saying that these individuals held at Guantanamo have a right of access to the federal courts. It's far-reaching, of course, because it means that no doubt many of these people will now go to the federal courts, although, as I understand it, it won't have any effects for the existing military commission proceedings against five of the individuals, which just started last week.
Right, and I wanted to ask about that. There are a small number of the detainees of the original 750 or so are actually charged with war crimes, and they're being tried not in civilian courts but by military commissions. How fair a trial can they expect? Are you troubled that those military commissions remain the forum for adjudicating their guilt or innocence?
I am pretty troubled about the way those military commissions are functioning. There are a number of problems with them. For example, it's normal in our system of justice not to take any account of material that may have been obtained by torture or through coercion. And some of the material in these proceedings will be allowed, which has been obtained in that way. I think it's important to recognize that the United States is fully entitled to take proceedings against individuals who have breached international laws, who've committed war crimes in relation to the United States. The problem is not that objective. It's how it's been implemented.
Give us a sense of how this process has actually worked.
Well, I think that there are a lot of people within the process who've expressed concerns about how it is functioning. I followed in particular one of the proceedings which concerned chap that I wrote about, Mohammed Al-Qahtani. In February of this year, the Pentagon announced that they were bringing charges against him, along with the five others who they have proceeded with, for war crimes, for targeting civilians, for murder. And then, rather surprisingly, out of the blue, a couple of weeks ago, they just dropped the charges. And I think that's indicative of a process that is deeply flawed. And I think we all sort of have the suspicion that they're speeding them up in order to get rid of them before the administration comes to an end and before there's a handover to the next presidency. And that isn't the way to do justice, and it's not the way to deal with these terribly important issues.
When you say speeding them up to get rid of them, what do you mean?
Well, I wonder, as I think many people wonder, why it is that we've started these proceedings now in some considerable haste in relation to the five individuals who are before the military commission. The administration of President Bush comes to an end, as we know, in about 6 months' time. And I think what I've picked up is that the hope is within the administration that they can charge and convict and sentence before President Bush leaves. Of course, we know from other reports that those in the upper echelons of the administration, including Mr. Rumsfeld's former lawyer, Jim Haynes, have expressed the view that this is one set of proceedings in which there won't be any acquittals. And it's very unhelpful, I think, for those kinds of statements to be made and not, I think, what we're used to or what we expect. So the whole process of military commission sort of sits in this cloud of unhappiness as to individual decisions that have been made and the prospects for fair trial. It's very troublesome.
if the intent is to get these folks tried and convicted quickly during the remainder of the current administration, why would they drop charges against this detainee you mentioned, Mohammed al-Qahtani?
Well, the timing on Mohammed al-Qahtani is very interesting. Initially, they had announced charges on the 11th of February of this year. I then wrote an article in Vanity Fair, which came out on the 2nd of April, and that was followed by hearings before the House Judiciary Committee and then the publication of my book. A week after the publication of my book, they announced, without giving any reasons, the dropping of all the charges against Mohammed al-Qahtani. And what I understand is that the view was taken, given the abuse he had been subjected to, was that he had become unprosecutable and that any proceedings that might be held against him would in effect become proceedings about the treatment he'd been subjected to by the administration. And so they just dropped it. It was a real bombshell, I have to say.
So in other words, facing the prospect of a trial, even before a military commission, at which his treatment and interrogation would become widely publicized and an issue, it appears they decided to simply drop the charges.
It does indeed appear that they simply decided to drop the charges. What's so staggering about this is not just any individual. The gentleman concerned, who's detainee 063, who has the name Mohammed al-Qahtani, is said by the administration to be the 20th hijacker. In other words, he's the guy who turned up at Orlando Airport in August 2001. It is said to be met by Mohammed Atta and then was refused entry to Orlando. He's sent back to the Middle East. He turns up in Afghanistan in November, is caught, sent to Guantanamo in February 2002. And then in June 2002, they discover that he's the very same guy that they have refused entry to the previous year at Orlando Airport. And they put two and two together. They say he's the 20th hijacker. And they then decide this guy is not broken under normal techniques of interrogation. They're going to move to more aggressive techniques. So he's not just any old person. He has a particular significance in the whole scheme of things. And that's why a decision to drop charges against him seems very staggering.
If he is so dangerous, and if they have dropped charges, what happens to him now?
Well, that's an excellent question. Who knows? I mean, what are the options? One option is that he just remain where he is for the rest of his life or in some other place if Guantanamo is shut down. It is possible under the Geneva Conventions to have security detentions, in other words, to hold people until the end of a conflict because they pose such a threat. He is, by all accounts, I've not met him, but by all accounts of those who have met him, rather a broken individual, and it's not immediately clear that he poses a serious threat. The other option, of course, is to do what's happened to so many of the other detainees, whether they are innocent or not, is to release them. That's happened to all the British detainees. They all live now back in the United Kingdom. They've all been released. And I somehow think that's unlikely in relation to an individual who's a Saudi national and who has this aura hanging over him of the 20th hijacker. I think it's very difficult to justify releasing him in those circumstances. So they're going to have to come up with something.
Give us just a bit of a context here. There were nearly 800 people housed in Guantanamo at the height of its activity, I guess, in 2002. More than 500 have been released. What do we know about how many of these folks were mistakenly detained and kind of what their real crimes, if any, were?
Well, I think there's no doubt that some of the individuals who've been held at Guantanamo are problematic individuals in the sense that they have launched attacks against the United States in ways that may breach international laws, or they may have been involved in planning attacks, or indeed they may have been involved in actual attacks. But I think the best sense that I have from the vast majority of people that I spoke to is that the great majority of people don't actually pose a threat to the United States. I've met a few of them who were individuals who were caught up completely accidentally, traded, they were sold to the Americans by the Pakistanis. I'm thinking of a German detainee by the name of Murat Kurnaz, and who ended up spending 5 years in Guantanamo. And in a sense, my best source of information is the guy who was the combatant commander at Guantanamo in that crucial first year, name of Mike Dunleavy, who I interviewed on numerous occasions. He described to me how very early on he formed the view that most of the people at Guantanamo were completely useless individuals who posed no threat to the United States. And when he went to the Pentagon and said, we need to get rid of these people because they're taking up valuable space, he was met with the response, no way, we're going to hold on to them, we don't admit to error, everyone's going to stay. And so I think there was early on knowledge that errors had been made, but a sort of hubristic desire not actually to own up to it, as a result of which a great number of people have remained unnecessarily, and a great deal of harm has been caused to the reputation of the US.
Well, Philippe Sands, I want to talk a little bit about what happened in Guantanamo and the legal authority for it, and to give us some of the sense of the context. A key detainee who you've mentioned is a Saudi named Mohammed al-Qahtani. He was the guy who they argued was the 20th hijacker. And it was the frantic efforts to get him to talk more that seemed to have led in 2002 to the efforts to get legal authorization for more aggressive interrogation techniques. And you write in your book about what actually happened to him once the decision was made to be more aggressive in interrogating him. Give us a sense of what he went through, a couple of days of his interrogation.
Well, he went through what they call enhanced coercive interrogation. I would call it torture, having discussed it with various clinical psychiatrists who've been over his interrogation log. And that happened over a period of 54 days. It began on the 23rd of November 2002. It ended following the intervention of a number of people who objected vigorously to this in the US military in early January 2003. The center of gravity of the techniques was really to humiliate him and degrade him to the point that he would break. So they would use, for example, techniques of making him stand naked for extended periods of time. They would tape to his body pictures of 9/11 victims. He would be touched and poked by a semi-clad female military officer. A dog would be in the vicinity growling at him. In fact, at one point, I think he was asked to perform dog tricks and to growl aggressive noises towards al-Qaeda people and to growl gentle noises towards victims of 9/11. He was subjected to continuous noise. He was subjected to very great extremes of temperature to the point that at one stage in early December, he became subject to severe hypothermia and had to be hospitalized. What I think was most striking about all of this to me was throughout this entire rather shocking process, doctors were in evidence. Medical doctors were in evidence and were checking, essentially, that he continued to be fit to go through this process.
You know, I think listeners, when they hear each of those things individually, might think, well, you know, that's not pleasant, but it doesn't quite sound like torture. Is it the combination and cumulative impact of these over a long period of time that really takes its toll?
Dave, that reaction, frankly, was the reaction that I first had when I went over this. And it was only when I had the benefit. I mean, the techniques look shocking in that way, but you think to yourself, well, this isn't, you know, pulling fingernails out type of stuff. It doesn't reach that level. Then I sat down with a clinical psychiatrist who is a specialist in trauma, who took me through the whole interrogation log. She marked it up, in fact, with these multicolored pens. And in particular, she was looking for signs of distress. And everywhere she found signs of distress, she marked that in blue. And by the end of the process, the 80 pages or so were absolutely sort of marked up in blue all over. It's the combination of techniques. To take one example, sleep deprivation. Over a period of 54 days, he got no more than 3 or 4 hours sleep in any 24-hour period. In other words, so extensive interrogations over 20-hour periods. That type of sleep deprivation, I'm told, by people down at Guantanamo who objected to these techniques, would render an individual within 4 or 5 days spouting complete rubbish. We would not be able to cope with what he went through in terms simply of sleep deprivation. And even in those 3 or 4 hours where he was allowed to sleep, he was woken up, there were loud noises played, there was pop music being played. And within 4 or 5 days, as it was explained to me, he will have been broken. So it's the accumulation of these techniques, without any limits being placed, being used over extended periods of time, would have left him in a situation where, frankly, he would not really have been able to provide meaningful, reliable information, even if he had any to give.
And what do we know about the effect on al-Qahtani?
Well, we know that it left him in a shockingly bad state. I mean, there are plenty of accounts of him being spotted, crawled up in a fetal position. We know from the interrogation log the distress that he went through. And I know, as I've described in the book, from having spoken to the head of his exploitation team, that nothing meaningful came out of this. And in fact, that's no surprise at all. There was a tremendous battle that went on down at Guantanamo between a small group who were in favour of this, who were essentially being pressurised from the top, from Donald Rumsfeld's office directly, and many others who had real experience in interrogation, clinical psychologists with the Naval Criminal Investigation Service, officers with the FBI, who strongly objected. And their objections were not just that these actions were illegal, but that they wouldn't produce meaningful information, that it didn't work, it didn't make sense to put this individual through those techniques at this stage, even if he had any information.
It's interesting that when you appeared at a congressional subcommittee in May, you said that the British experience in dealing with IRA attacks in Northern Ireland was instructive on this particular point. What lesson do you draw from that experience about inflicting pain and discomfort, approaching torture in interrogating prisoners?
The British experience in particular, as you've mentioned, I think is a relevant one. In 1971, the British moved to using five techniques of interrogation. They're actually very similar to the techniques authorised by Donald Rumsfeld: hooding, stress positions, sensory deprivation, sleep deprivation, and so on and so forth. They didn't last for very long. They didn't last for very long because, firstly, it soon became clear that they didn't produce any useful, reliable information. But secondly, it became even clearer that they were a recruiting tool. They were used as a recruiting tool for those, if you like, who were objecting to Britain's actions and to Britain's involvement in Northern Ireland. And interestingly, after that congressional hearing, which just took place a month ago, I visited Northern Ireland. I went to Belfast to talk about my book. And during the course of the session, a lady at the back of the room put her hand up and described to me, she said, I was in the IRA, and in 1971, in that period, she was interned. And she said, I wasn't subject to those techniques, but in fact, many of my colleagues, many of my friends were. And it was the best recruiting tool that we could have. And the British government takes the view, I think, along with many, that the use of those techniques, combined with other things, extended the conflict with the IRA by more than 10 years, probably more than 15 years, and made it much more difficult to resolve the issues. And I fear that that's exactly what's happened here. So that Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, Kandahar, Bagram have become iconic. They've become emblematic. If you go to capitals and cities in the Middle East, if you go to Cairo, to other places, you'll see pictures of these types of abusive events. They're used to recruit, and that is something, it seems, the administration never turned its mind to consider.
You told members of Congress that because of the experience with the United Kingdom and Northern Ireland, that you won't find British officials using the expression the war on terror. Why?
That's right. You won't even find former Prime Minister Tony Blair or current Prime Minister Gordon Brown using the expression war on terror. Again, it comes from the experience with the IRA. The formal words war on terror elevates the individuals who were involved in the struggle then against Britain, now against the United States and Britain, to warriors. And by elevating their status to warrior, the feeling is that you legitimate in some way their actions. These are serious criminals. They're bad criminals, and they're not warriors. And the view's been taken by the British that we're not going to elevate their status and give them that type of characterization. And I think it's the right call. There are exact parallels with what happened with the IRA in terms of their wanting prisoner of war status, their wanting to be treated under the Geneva Conventions in particular ways. And the British government took a view long ago that that was not the way that they were going to go, and that they would be subject to a process of criminal enforcement in order, if you like, to delegitimize the struggle that was taking place. Whether it worked or not, I think it's for others to decide. But here, it seems that very soon after September the 11th, the decision was taken to move to a characterization of the war on terror. And I think it was a big mistake, because it has transformed what is a serious threat into a threat involving, if you like, warriors on the other side. And coming back to a point I made earlier, that tends to help in recruitment.
You know, when you made these points before Congress, you were challenged by another attorney who said that, in fact, the tough interrogations of IRA members by the British in 1971 and 72, however distasteful, squeezed out the names of approximately 700 IRA operatives, thus assisting the British in their effort to find terrorists and root them out of the population. Does he have a point?
He doesn't have a point. He's talking out of his backside, I'm afraid, and there's no evidence to show that at all. I've met with people who are who were interrogators in that process. I've met with people who were in the British Army in that process. It was not felt to be helpful. In fact, that is why it was dropped very, very quickly. It was another one of what I thought of as a sort of Monty Python moment of those hearings. That was one of them, when you have a witness who's really talking completely off the top of his head. And part of the approach of those who are really pushing for a move to coercion is to simplify it, to become ahistorical, to just stop looking at what actually happened in reality, and literally just to make things up in order to get through the day and to justify what is unjustifiable.
Even if you decide that you're going to treat detainees humanely when you interrogate them and adhere to, you know, past practices, which are built on building rapport rather than coercion and inflicting pain, you do have this issue of what you do with folks who are accused of terrorist acts. And, you know, in the United States, what they say is that we can't afford these folks all of the protection of the American legal system because we don't have all of the prosecutorial and investigative tools that we have in the United States to look into criminals. It's a very different circumstance. You may not be able to meet all the burdens of proof that you would have in a civilian court. And I'm wondering, how did the British deal with that issue, the detention of people accused of terrorist crimes who they felt they couldn't necessarily proved by civilian court standards, but whom they felt were too dangerous to release?
Basically, the approach taken by the British is to distinguish between two different types of situation. One type of situation is where you are truly involved in some sort of armed conflict. So, for example, the situation now in Afghanistan, the situation in Iraq. And in those circumstances, the rules are clear. There are very stringent limits that you can place on interrogation. The other group of people, people caught up in Pakistan or, you know, picked up in different parts of the world and then flown into Guantanamo or Kandahar or Bagram for questioning and so on and so forth, you would take through the normal criminal process. And it may well be amended to take into account the situation we now face. So, for example, in the English context, we do have a series of secret hearings, but everyone is entitled to counsel. Everyone has their barrister, has their lawyer to help them out. Some of the evidence is not open evidence and so can't be looked at in accordance with the normal rules. In order to protect sources, in order to make sure that material doesn't emerge into the public domain, it's a very difficult balance to strike. And I think what's really gone wrong is that these issues were never fully thought through. And what ought to have happened is a more sort of collaborative effort. What do we do with these peoples? Are the rules adequate? If they're not adequate, how can we collectively address them? And the failure to do that, I think, is what's got the US and Britain into a very real mess right now.
You said something intriguing in your congressional testimony. You mentioned that you advise foreign governments and that once the president of another country referred to one of the memos from the Bush administration, which endorsed aggressive interrogation techniques. Could you describe that incident?
Yeah, no, well, I mean, I wear different hats. I teach at the university, but I'm also a barrister, which is a sort of practicing lawyer. I work in the field of international law, so most of the clients that I work for are governments. So frequently I come into conversation with senior government officials, with presidents, with foreign ministers, with ministers of justice, with attorney generals. And one of the things that struck me in the period, in particular after 2004, when all of these memos, the legal advices, the torture memos by John Yoo and Jay Bybee and other documents came into the public domain, was how far they had reached around the globe. You know, we live in this extraordinary globalized world now where documents don't just stay within Britain, within the United States. They travel instantly, but by internet, and they travel into the hands of senior government officials. And I've had conversations with more than one president, actually, with more than one foreign minister, in which they've talked about these memos. On one occasion, at least, one of these people got out a memo. They had a copy of it. And the basic line that you get is, look, if the United States is getting these legal advices now and saying these things are all right to do, why can't we do them too? And frankly, it's a powerful point. It's very difficult to resist that point. I've always held the United States in the highest esteem as a country that is so strongly committed to the rule of law and which has had a tremendous moral authority in saying we don't do that kind of stuff. And the terrible tragedy of these memos and that dark period is that they have migrated into the hands of people who now say, well, Americans do it, we're going to do it also. And I think that's a long-term problem that is going to take us many years to overcome and recover from.
And what was your role in advising them?
Oh, I advise, I mean, on a whole raft of different issues. My practice area is extremely wide, so it could be boundary disputes, it could be foreign investment disputes, it could be trade disputes. In some cases, it could be, you know, environmental disputes. What I'm not doing, just to be absolutely clear, is I'm not advising on what techniques of interrogation they can and cannot use. And I suppose that is the most curious thing of all. I can be there talking about issues that have absolutely nothing to do with interrogation techniques. And out of the blue, I'll be asked, Mr. Sands, what do you think about this memo? What do you think about the memo by Jay Bybee or John Yoo on such and such issue? And if the Americans are moving to waterboarding, why can't we move to waterboarding? In fact, I had a very curious conversation once with a very senior representative of the Bush administration, and I put it to him. Didn't it occur to you as you went to waterboarding that if you justify the use of waterboarding, others are going to justify the use of waterboarding against American soldiers? And he had no answer to that. There is no answer to that. It's a, you know, it shows the sort of hopelessness of the argument.
You know, 10 years ago, you were involved in a case where a high-ranking government official, former head of state, was called to account for allegedly torturing and murdering citizens of his own country and others. That was the Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet. Remind us after why, decades after his alleged crimes, he was arrested in London.
Well, the decades after point, I think, is an important one because these things linger and they then have explosive little consequences in ways that are entirely unforeseeable. He came to London in October 1998 for medical treatment. He was a great friend of a former British Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher, and he felt that Britain was a friend of his in which he could gain, he was safe and he would gain serious medical treatment for whatever illness he had at the time. One night on a Friday, I think it was the 16th of October, there was a knock on his door and a number of police officers came in and arrested him. And they arrested him because a Spanish prosecutor by the name of Judge Garzon had issued an arrest warrant for allegations of torture and indeed a whole load of other crimes carried out in Chile in the period 1973 to 1990, so much, much earlier on. And the significance about those acts, the acts of torture and then related acts, is that they fall within something called universal jurisdiction. That's to say, they are international crimes which any country in the world has an obligation to prosecute if an individual turns up in their country or to extradite the person to a place where that person will be prosecuted. And so Pinochet arrives in the UK, a Spanish prosecutor makes the request, and the British authorities have no option but to take action on the Spanish request. And there then followed 18 months of legal proceedings in which the decision was taken that he could, in fact, be extradited to Spain to face trial for allegations of torture, but in fact, bad health cut in and he was sent back to Chile. But the significance of the case was it established the principle that even a former head of state who is alleged to have committed torture will not be able to gain immunity from the jurisdiction of courts. And that has had a tremendous freezing effect on the travel of individuals who are alleged to have engaged in acts of this kind.
Well, that gets to a really critical question here. I mean, if it's been established in the Pinochet case that one who commits crimes against humanity is vulnerable to prosecution anywhere, and if it is becoming clearer with your work and other things that are happening now, including new hearings in Congress, that high-ranking government officials were involved in authorizing or ordering techniques which could be described as torture, are any of the officials of the Bush administration vulnerable to prosecution?
I think they're extremely vulnerable to investigation. You know, last week, a group of 56 congressmen wrote a letter to the Attorney General asking for the appointment of a special counsel to look at the suggestion and the evidence that violations of criminal laws, US and international, had occurred. I don't know where that initiative is going to go, but it shows the extent to which there is now a broad recognition that something went wrong, that a crime was committed, and the fact that a crime was committed, you don't need to take from me. The Supreme Court ruled in one of its earlier decisions, Hamdan versus Rumsfeld, that the Geneva Conventions applied at Guantanamo. Common Article 3, which prohibits outrages and cruelty and torture, applied. And the consequence of that, of course, is that the individual we were talking about earlier, Mohammed al-Qahtani, his interrogation plainly violated Common Article 3, and it seems a war crime has been committed. And it may well be that torture was committed, in which case individuals associated with that decision are not just theoretically exposed to serious risk of investigation. And that goes right to the top. It goes to Mr. Rumsfeld, it goes to Mr. Rumsfeld's lawyer, Jim Haynes, and others down the chain of command who played an active role in authorising the techniques of interrogation, which is why the issue of where it all started becomes so important, and why the administration's narrative that it started at the bottom and then just trickled up is, I think, necessary to explore much further. But the bottom line is very, very clear. If you engage in torture, if you are complicit in torture, if you participate in torture, you expose yourself to the risk of investigation anywhere in the world. And that is a risk that applies to anyone of any nationality. And being a former administration official doesn't help. So the immunity that the administration has tried to create with the Military Commissions Act will have no effect outside the United States, nor will any possible pardon by President Bush, which apparently is being suggested in relation to some of these characters, that too won't have any consequence outside of the United States.
Well, let's just be clear about this. Are you saying that if someone in any country in the world judges that war crimes have been committed and a former official of the Bush administration a year from now travels to one of those countries, they have the legal authority to detain them and try them?
Absolutely. I mean, I can go further than that. One of the chapters in my book right at the end describes the conversations I had with a European judge and a European prosecutor, very experienced in these issues. I went to see them in a European capital. I laid out all of the material. I gave them all of the documents that I'd come up with. I showed them, you know, the paper trail of decision making. And I asked specifically because I was interested in particular in the role of the lawyers. I was amazed that some of these lawyers had signed off on these techniques when they were so obviously contrary to the United States' international obligations. Could these lawyers be within the frame?
When you say within the frame, you
within
mean?
Within the frame of criminal investigation. Could they be subject to criminal investigation in a serious country outside the United States for having been complicit in a decision which amounts to the authorization of torture? And the answer to that question, after lengthy conversation, was yes. I think that it's very, very clear that if the lawyers who authorize these techniques are subject to potential investigation, then most certainly the politicians who authorize them are in the frame of potential investigation. And that goes very high. I mean, that includes Mr. Rumsfeld, it includes Mr. Cheney. It even includes, astonishingly, Mr. Bush, because just a few weeks ago he gave a statement in which, if I read it correctly, he appeared to be saying that these techniques were approved by principals and that he signed off on them. And that appears to be an acceptance of responsibility from the very highest levels of the administration. So it's a very serious matter. I assume they're just proceeding on the basis that because they're from the United States, no one's actually going to do anything about it.
In your book, Torture Team, which looks at the Bush administration's development of legal authorization for tough, aggressive techniques of interrogation in Guantanamo, you fly around the country and meet all kinds of people who were involved, a common pleas judge in Erie who was a commander there. But you also find a woman named Diane Beaver, who was a military lawyer, and hers is a fascinating story. What was her role?
I'd come across her when I'd written my first book, Lawless World, back in 2004, 2005. I came across the legal advice that she wrote in her capacity as the lawyer at Guantanamo who was selected to sign off on interrogation techniques. She was the staff judge advocate, long-standing military lawyer. I read her legal advice and I thought it was ghastly and awful and horrible. And I was, shall we say, pretty rude about it in Lawless World. For this book, I wanted to meet her, and I wanted to meet all the other decision makers. And I tracked her down with the help of a friend in the State Department, and I've spent extended periods of time talking with her. I think, actually, she's a decent and honourable person. And I still don't like her legal advice, but what I discovered was that she was put in a position that she should never have been put in. As she described to me, the president had decided that the Geneva Conventions didn't apply at Guantanamo. So when I went to the rule book to see what interrogation techniques existed, the pages were blank, and I had to start from scratch. And I have to say, in a certain sense, I mean, I hope I wouldn't have come up with the advice she did, but in a certain sense, I have a sympathy for her having been put in that position. You know, an individual with very limited experience on these issues being asked to approve new techniques of interrogation that the U.S. has never before used.
I think one of the most fascinating things about the Diane Beaver story is that she struggles through under great pressure and develops these techniques of interrogation, which she suggests may be legal, assuming that this will be passed up the line and reviewed repeatedly by more senior lawyers in the military and in, you know, civilian command roles. And instead, she is it, right?
No, Dave, this is the heart of the story, because the narrative that emerges from Jim Haynes and others is that they relied on Diane Beaver's advice.
Jim Haynes being the top Pentagon lawyer, right?
Mr. Haynes was Mr. Rumsfeld's lawyer, the top Pentagon lawyer. He puts her document into the public domain. He doesn't even redact her name. You know, the document is put out, legal advice with her name on it. It's not blacked out. And so her name becomes mud, not only in the United States, but all across the world. And the impression is created that it is her legal advice which was relied on. Then she tells me her story. She was asked originally, on her account, to sign off verbally. And she declined to do so. She decided that what she was going to do was put her advice in writing, in the expectation that as it went up the chain of command, as it went up the decision-making process, more senior and more experienced lawyers would be able to express a view on it. And if it didn't pass muster, someone would overturn it. That never happened. And of course, we now know the reason that it never happened is that it never got to those more senior lawyers. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs, lawyer Jane Dalton, has described how Mr. Haynes intervened to basically short-circuit the decision-making process. And none of the military lawyers at the more senior level who were experienced in these areas got a chance to review Diane Beaver's work. So her plan, good as it was, did not succeed at that time, although ultimately I think it did succeed, because if she had not put her document in writing, people like me and many others would not have focused on it, and we would not have begun to dig away to uncover the truth of what has happened. But essentially, my view of Diane Beaver is that she should never have been put in the position that she was put in, and she has been scapegoated by people at the top and used as a convenient individual to justify actions when legal advices from the Department of Justice and others were in fact relied upon in the background to justify the measures that were taken.
You know, the Bush administration is on its last 7 months. We'll have a new president in January. What do you think we can expect then on these issues?
Well, that's an excellent question. Both remaining presidential candidates have declared that they will be shutting down Guantanamo. And, of course, we no longer have use by the military of aggressive forms of interrogation. They have been outlawed. They have gone by the wayside. What remains is the use of aggressive forms of interrogation by the CIA and by related persons, private contractors working with the CIA. There also remains, though, as I've mentioned, the question of immunity for past acts. And I think the single biggest issue that the next president is going to have to face is going to be the question of what to do about the past. I talked about this with the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, John Conyers, after the hearings when I appeared last month. We had a lengthy conversation about it, and I formed from him and from many others I've talked with a view about what's going to happen. I think it's much more likely that Senator Obama will go far in seeking to get to the truth of what happened. I rather have the sense that, given some of his recent statements, Senator McCain is going to try to push a lot of this under the carpet, try to move forward in the right direction, but not put too much scrutiny on who was responsible, because that would force him, I think, to look at the upper echelons of the Bush administration. I hope that whoever is president will look in detail at what has happened, because if the United States doesn't get its own house in order, other countries are very likely to move to investigations of their own, including criminal investigations, about what happened. And I don't think that's a desirable thing. I'd like to see the United States sort itself out, the United States come to terms with what actually happened. And once those facts have been established, then the question happens what to do with those persons who are truly responsible if crimes were committed, as I believe to be the case.
Well, Philippe Sens, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It's terrific to join you. Thank you so much, Dave.
International human rights attorney Philippe Sens. His new book is Torture Team, Rumsfeld's Memo and the Betrayal of American Values. Nigerian writer Akpan has just published his first collection of short stories, but he's already received much acclaim for a fledgling author. He was a finalist for the Kane Prize for African Writing, and two of his short stories have been published in The New Yorker magazine. Book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Akpan's debut collection called Say You're One of Them.
Remember Holden Caulfield's famously ironic literary fantasy in Catcher in the Rye? The one about how when you read a book you love, you feel so connected to the author, you just want to call him or her up and talk and talk? It's famously ironic, of course, because few fans have ever chatted with the super reclusive J.D. Salinger. Well, I flashed on Holden's fantasy after reading Akpan's short story collection, Say You're One of Them. I wouldn't claim I love the collection. That's too happy, too easeful a word to use in reference to these despairing stories. Unfortunately for me, I don't feel connected to Akpan. His world is one in which atrocity is commonplace. The unthinkable is the everyday. No, I feel the naive urge to call Akpan up and talk because judging from his life and work, I think he's someone especially suited to respond to the million-dollar theological question. That is, why does God permit evil to flourish in the world? You see, Akpan is not just an already acclaimed new Nigerian writer on the Anglo-Afro literary scene. He's also a Jesuit priest. All of his stories are told through the perspectives of children, a Kenyan boy who lives with his family on the streets and sniffs glue to tamp down hunger, a Christian girl in Ethiopia who's abruptly torn from her Muslim best friend, a Rwandan girl who witnesses her Hutu father forced to machete her Tutsi mother. Evil is gleefully triumphant in these stories. Human society is chaos, and children, its lightest, most fragile members, are sucked down into the horror just as vividly as Edgar Allan Poe's victim was sucked down into the maelstrom. So my impulse is to call up Father Akpan and ask how someone with such an intimate knowledge of hell in his writings can still obviously affirm in his life the existence of a benevolent God. Because in these stories, when evil comes through the door in the form of human tribal enemies, the only defense the narrator's parents, the minor household deities here, can offer their children is to, in the chilling words of the title story, say you're one of them. Maybe Akpan will explore that central theological mystery in a nonfiction book one day. In this collection, his aim seems to be to unflinchingly dramatize partisan hatred at work. Akpan's brilliance is to present that brutal subject through the bewildered, resolutely chipper voice of children, and he never succumbs to the temptation of making his narrators endearing or overly innocent. All five of these stories are electrifying, but the one I find myself thinking about the most is one of the longest, over 100 pages, called Fattening for Gabon. It takes place over 3 months and has the slow, sinister feel of a dark fairy tale. In it, our narrator, a boy aged 10, and his sister, 5, are sent to live with their uncle because their parents are dying of AIDS. The uncle does a deal with the devil and sells the children into slavery, although the kids don't know that. They just see a new motorbike appear one day in their uncle's hut. They're treated to fattening feasts of bushmeat and pepper soup by a pair of fawning godparents who plan to stick them in the bottom of a boat and smuggle them across the border to Gabon. The boy begins to catch on, but to give himself and his sister a chance of survival, he acts dumb and feels bad about himself for being good at it. He says, referring to his captors, "I felt I had learned evil from them. I had learned to smile and be angry at the same time." Akpan's narrators speak in a hodgepodge patois of French and African languages and English. They have a gift for rough metaphor, For instance, an 8-year-old boy, the hope of his homeless family, who narrates the lead-off story called An Xmas Feast, describes his sister and her fellow prostitutes as fluttering about under streetlights, dressed like winged termites. The distinct voices of these child narrators and the horrors they bear witness to make Say You're One of Them a haunting debut short story collection. Or perhaps it would be more faithful to the bleak tone of these stories to say that readers will be damned to remember them.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Say You're One of Them by Umm Akpan. To read an excerpt or hear Akpan read from his collection, visit our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of Fresh Air.